drawn so many people in, the Thomas must be black holes, but the only thing can draw so many people in.
You may also be aware
that was a remark of great gravity.
Gets worse before it gets better. You may also be aware that we had a variety of cancellations through this series because of winter snowstorms. We finally gave up trying to reschedule talks during the winter weather, so we pushed the talks all back, and that means the next talk, instead of being approximately a month from today, will be 2 weeks from today, April 27th, Thursday again, 7:30 in here. The last section of the Voyager recording will be played. The topic then will be Earth, the weirdest planet of all, continental drift. And then in May, the last of this current series for this school term, on May 11th, the second Thursday of the month, will be Skylab Tour of the United States, Part 1. And our speaker, for those of you who are making your first visit here, Jim Loudon, commentator on space and astronomy for National Public Radio. Extremely interesting speaker. Topic today, black holes.
Thank you very much. That was Lee Shapiro, who is the director of Abrams Planetarium and is the reason I'm here, so I want to thank him for that fine introduction and also for the fact that I am here. Seems only fair, though, to start off with a little bit of truth in advertising, and that is warn you what you're in for. Maybe I should have thought to tell you this last time, for those that were here last time anyway. I know there are some new people. And that is, I hope that you were not expecting anything terribly revolutionary or world-shaking. This series is designed to be on the elementary level for people who have no background in the subject. And that has not been much of a problem for most of the things that I've talked about, which have been subjects, for example, results of space investigations, that have been so unpublicized that very few people could be assumed to have any previous knowledge of them whatsoever. Furthermore, that happens to be, planetary science happens to be the area of astronomy in which I am most knowledgeable, and so I could always be pretty guaranteed, even for those that had a lot of background, to be able to throw in a lot of details, at least, that they never heard before. And in this particular case, we may have the opposite situation. This is a lecture where you probably know more than the other subjects, and I probably know less than the other subjects. And I don't mean that I know nothing about it. I think I can fake it enough to give you a reasonably elementary lecture. But some of you have undoubtedly been doing some reading about black holes, and all I'm going to do here is talk on the very elementary level about what a black hole is. So, you know, if we have drawn you out here, drawn you in, under false pretenses, I will not take it personally if somebody wants to get up and leave. I hope you all stay, but it seems only fair to warn you what I'm going to do. In particular, I've made a kind of painful decision, and that is that I am not going to talk at all about the general relativistic aspects of black holes. And to do any sort of really thorough treatment of the subject, you've got to talk general relativity. The problem is that for a lecture to an audience in which the ground rules are that we assume, you know, everybody's invited and you don't have any background necessarily, I would first have to explain general relativity before I could talk about the applications of it to black holes. There simply is not time to do that, even if I am competent to do it, which I'm not all sure I am, because that's just about on the opposite side of this huge field called astronomy from planetary science, which is what I know the most about. And what that means is, I'm not going to say very much about some things that some of you may have come hoping to find out all about, and that is wormholes, Einstein-Rosen bridges, possibility, mathematical, theoretical, in quotes possibility, of using black holes to travel to another universe, whatever that means. It never seems to be defined very well. I don't apologize too much for that, and the reason is this. Black holes so far, and this is probably going to be the single most important thing I say about them the whole night. This is really the bottom line of the whole lecture. Black lines, the whole lecture, get it? Black holes are so far an entirely theoretical concept. We do not know for sure that even one of them exists anywhere in the universe. There are theoretical reasons to believe that many of them exist. it. In fact, it's been suggested that as much as 90% of the mass of the universe, the material in the universe, is in the form of black holes. They may be very well be very common. Furthermore, there are a number of astronomical objects which a lot of astronomers show very strong evidence for being, in fact, black holes, but we are not absolutely certain at this point. And the problem with trying to establish that a whole new class of phenomena exists is that when you don't know in advance that they do, you're very reluctant to state absolutely positively, yes, this thing exists. We have the same problem with life on Mars. If we knew that life existed on Mars, then we would not be very hesitant about ascribing many of the results of the Viking biology experiments to life. Certainly, if you ran those same experiments in, oh, say, some remote desert area on Earth, and you got the results that have been obtained from the Viking biology investigation, nobody would have the slightest hesitation in saying, yeah, the reason for that is you got germs in there, you got bacteria and so on, and they're reproducing and eating and metabolizing and giving you those results. But when you don't know that life exists on Mars, and when all you know is that you don't know, then you have to be super cautious you have to have absolutely incontrovertible evidence before you are willing to say that yes, indeed, that's what's causing it. Same sort of thing with black holes. There are objects, something called Cygnus X1, very recently Sir Sinus X1, and even more recently than that, a very different kind of black hole, supermassive one, perhaps in the center of the giant elliptical galaxy, M87. All of these are good candidates for being black holes, but you want to be really, really certain, and there are other possible explanations, rather contrived ones, perhaps even more unlikely than black holes in some cases. But nevertheless, we can't be certain. Okay, so, everything that I'm going to tell you tonight about what a black hole is, please understand that that's a shorthand for this is what a black hole is if in fact they exist at all. Okay, in other words, I'm going to talk theory at you the whole night, and I will discuss the observational attempts that have been made to observe them, and you know why we think Cygnus X1 and the others are good candidates and so forth. Well, the problem is that theoretical mathematicians, especially cosmologists, who are dealing with the branch of astronomy in which there is the smallest amount of observational data, tend, by necessity, they have to work largely in speculative realms. You know, equations, no matter what branch of mathematics, when they're applied to science, are not anything magic, they're not anything that tell you something that you didn't know from the observations. They are simply ways of describing the observations, and then you set up, you write equations which gives you some physical law which you think incorporates all the observations, and then you use the rules of mathematics to manipulate that and come up with results. And sometimes those results are correct. That is to say, they make predictions. If you make such and such an observation, you will see such and such a result. And sometimes it turns out that they're not correct, and then we go back and modify the equations that we had thought were right in the previous observation, and so on. That's the way mathematical science operates. The problem is we haven't had the chance to do that yet with black holes. What we can do is take the equations of general relativity, which are quite likely correct, but it is possible that, in fact, general relativity, which is generally considered to be our best theory of gravity, is wrong. There are other competing theories which predict different things. There are at least a few of them which say that such a thing as a black hole cannot exist, although most of them give black holes or black hole-like phenomena. But if you use general relativity, you come up with all these equations, and here's where I go off the deep end, and then you run through them and you come up with all sorts of outcomes, such as wormholes and all these other things that I've been talking about, which some of you have undoubtedly read about. And they may exist and they may not. We don't know because we don't have the observational evidence. The problem with this subject, in my opinion, and I've already warned you, I know less about this than some other areas of astronomy, and it's only fair to say that. You know, my opinion may be worth less here than it is when I talk to you about, say, the rings of Uranus. But in my opinion, the whole black hole situation has gotten to the point where the theory is so far removed from the observation that you simply want to chop off about the last 70% of the theory and say, well, it's nice science fiction, but, you know, let's not worry about it. Maybe it'll turn out to be true and maybe not. In particular, this thing about traveling to, quote, another universe. Well, in general relativity, gravity is described as a kind of warping of space, in fact, of space-time. And maybe that means something to you, maybe it doesn't. Suffice it to say that an analog of it is that a place where there's no gravitational field, an analog is a flat rubber sheet, and if you have a gravitational field, somebody has stuck their finger into the rubber sheet. Okay, in the case of a black hole, the distortion of the structure of space, which is of space-time, which is four-dimensional, and I'm using the two-dimensional analog of a rubber sheet so you can partially, dimly visualize what I'm talking about. There are equations which the structure is very severely modified. It's a very deep dimple. In fact, you can think of it as a dimple that's so deep that the rubber has split off. It's a separate little rubber ball that's formed all by itself down there. Okay, consider the dimple, though, above the rubber ball. That dimple is described by certain equations, which are field equations of general relativity. They involve a ferociously difficult branch of mathematics called tensor calculus. Special relativity, which I gave a lecture on last October, I think it was, Why You Can't Go Faster Than Light, has very simple mathematics, nothing more than high school algebra. Of course, I realize there are plenty of people here that feel that's bad enough, but believe me, it's very simple compared to tensor calculus. And the trouble with tensor calculus is it is so difficult that to get anywhere in trying to apply these equations, you have to do it, you have to make oversimplifications, you have to do it as simply as you possibly can. And so what you do in this particular investigation is you use an equation which describes the structure of the space around a black hole, ignoring the fact that that structure is caused by something down there at the bottom of the dimple, okay? And if you do this, then the equation says the dimple doesn't just come to a point. Coming to a point and stopping is something that in mathematics very often is not allowed to happen. That's called a singularity in mathematics, and singularities are often nasty things. Things tend to go to zero or infinity in unpleasant ways when you try to apply the equations. And what this shows is simply that, in fact, that's not really the way it happened. A more detailed examination of that particular region around what looks like a singularity would show, in fact, that it's not actually a point, it's, you know, a little curved thing. If you ignore that, if you cheerfully ignore the fact that the dimple is in space-time is caused by the presence of some mass there, then when you blindly run through the equation, you find that it opens out on the other side. There's another rubber sheet with another dimple down below the one that we've already punched the dimple in, and the two dimples are in contact at the singularity. Well, fine. That's what they mean by saying there's another universe on the other side of a black hole. The problem is those equations are oversimplified. They ignore the fact that the black hole is there. And so the question is, can you do this? Now, I'm oversimplifying this description. For one thing, I'm not telling you that the equations are different if the black hole is rotating and electrically charged, and that gives you a different structure, and maybe you can avoid going through it, and maybe you can't. We really don't know, and we don't know because all we've got is a theory, and we don't have enough observational evidence to check the predictions, the simpler predictions of the theory, the sorts of things that I am going to tell you about tonight. So it's entirely possible that this whole thing about it opening up on the other side, and that implies, of course, a whole other universe on the other side. So it's a very, very important prediction if, in fact, it's true. It's probable, it seems to me, that that is simply a mathematical fiction which is a result of using equations that are perfectly, oversimplified equations, that are perfectly all right to use up here, using them for down here. I'll give you a simple analogy. Suppose I write the equation which describes the behavior of a rifle bullet in a gravitational field. And, you know, it goes up and comes down a certain distance away. And I can write an equation which describes the exact shape, ignoring air resistance, that it will, of the trajectory. It turns out that in order to do that, it's a lot simpler if I pretend the Earth is flat, so that the direction of gravity is exactly parallel everywhere. Now, of course, the Earth is not flat, and the direction that is down here, the direction of gravity, is a little bit different from the direction that is down where the bullet is going to hit, but the difference is so tiny that it doesn't matter for practical purposes, and it's going to make it easier to do the math if I ignore that tiny difference and just pretend, okay, the Earth is flat, down is the same direction everywhere. Great. That's all right. Everything I've done now is fine, provided I remember the simplifications that I've made. But if I then take that same equation, which correctly describes the behavior of a rifle bullet, and try to apply it to the behavior of an intercontinental ballistic missile, which is going to go 5,000 miles, and then use it to show that the Earth is flat over a distance of 5,000 miles and say, see, here is this result that I've come up with from this equation. I have proved that the Earth is not spherical, that the Earth is flat. There is where I am misusing the equation. I am breaking the rules which allow me to do that simplification where the error was small. Okay? That's a simple analogy. The probability is, this is a conservative view perhaps, but I think the probability is that in fact that other universe thing is a mathematical fiction. However, it's entirely possible that 50 years from now, or even 5 years from now, we will have better information and therefore be able to plug it into the mathematics better, and it will turn out that in fact I've just made a fool of myself by saying all this. At the moment, I'm taking the conservative view, and black holes are an unbelievable enough phenomenon as it is, even at the, quote, elementary level, which is what I'm going to talk to you tonight about, that I don't think we really have to drag in things like Einstein-Rosen bridges just to make them more dramatic, okay? They're quite interesting enough as it is. Okay, and finally, I'd like to say that those of you, you know, I can't resist getting in an advertisement here. We have a lot of new people, and if you enjoy this lecture and you think, gee, that's interesting, you may not think that the Earth is interesting. One of the ironies of people that are interested in astronomy is they seem to be interested in everything except their own planet. Believe me, I was thinking very carefully when I chose that title, Earth, the weirdest planet of all. It is quite true, and I think you will find that whether or not you think in advance you'd be interested, if you enjoy this lecture tonight, which you already know you're interested in, I suspect you will find that, believe it or not, you will find the lecture 2 weeks from now to introduce all sorts of hidden goodies about this planet that you had no idea existed. So, give it a try. What I'm really trying to do is see if get as big as possible an audience so this planetarium will invite me back in the fall, but in addition, I'm doing this altruistically, you know, it is all for your own good. You know, if you come and hear these lectures, it is morally uplifting and that sort of thing.
You know better than that.
We had, for those of you who didn't know what all that music was, that was part three of four parts we've divided the recording that has been placed on the Voyager spacecraft into. The recordings are carried by each of the two spacecraft. Those are on the way to Jupiter and Saturn now. If you'd like more information about that, come last lecture. Because that's what I talked about in the last lecture. But or come to Ann Arbor if you're really interested in September, and I'll get to telling you about this in a minute. The recording it's going in interstellar space along with the spacecraft, and the idea is to identify us to any hypothetical extraterrestrial culture which might someday, millions, more likely billions of years from now, find this tiny little spacecraft, 12-foot diameter spacecraft, in the immensity of interstellar space. And we cannot say that there might not be some sort of technology which would allow them to find that. You know, the way to find a needle in a haystack, which sounds like an impossible difficulty if you happen to live in a culture that has not yet invented the magnet, is very simple if you live in a culture that has. You know, so it's possible. Well, one of the pieces on there was a prelude and fugue by Bach, and it was played by Glenn Gould, Canadian pianist. And he says, most people listen to Bach the way they take castor oil. They don't expect to enjoy it, but they think it'll be good for them. Okay, so what I'm trying to convince you is come here about the Earth and you may enjoy it and it will be good for you too. Finally, I'm going to try to make the lecture a little bit shorter than usual, not only because I have less to say than usual, but because there is an excellent chance that there will be a spectacular aurora tonight. Aurora is the correct term for what people have a tendency to refer to as northern lights if they're not astronomers. Actually, that's a bad name because there are southern lights as well. You have them around the South Magnetic Pole as well. Aurorae are caused by particles, fragments of atoms, mostly protons, which are thrown out from the sun as a result of enormous explosions on the sun, which are called solar flares. Now, solar flares happen all the time. Some of them are bigger and better and more spectacular than others. There was one 2 days ago, which is what is called an importance 2 flare. And the biggest ones are importance 1, then you got importance 2, importance 3, I can't remember if it was importance 4 or 9, I don't know, and then the smallest are called subflares, and they're the most common. An importance 2 is an explosion, maybe 50 billion times as violent as the Hiroshima atomic bomb. In other words, enough to give us, about as much energy as the human race has ever used in its history, every second or so of its existence, which typically is some number of minutes. So the things are exceedingly violent. They throw material into space at many different speeds, depending on, well, where the material comes from and so forth. And while we don't understand about the details of this, including what causes these explosions in the first place, some of it hits the Earth at practically the speed of light, and so it takes only 8 minutes to go the 93 million miles from the Sun to the Earth, and that tells you the rest of it is coming. That hit yesterday and destroyed radio communication temporarily in the polar regions especially. Our magnetic field tends to funnel these electrically charged particles in towards the magnetic poles. That's why you have more aurora in the polar regions as well. The polar ones are the ones that cause the aurora. They travel at about 600 miles an hour. And so they take about 2 days to reach us, and that means they should be hitting us right about now and through the next several hours, and that means tonight. I can't guarantee there's going to be one. All I can say is this flare was a fairly big one, and it was on the edge of the Sun as seen from Earth. That is where the magnetic field lines which conduct these particles to us through interplanetary space are more or less aimed at the Earth if they come from that particular spot on the Sun. So the chances are maybe 80% that we're going to have a really spectacular aurora. It requires no special equipment, no particular knowledge of astronomy, nothing at all. Just go out, find yourself a place where there aren't a million lights shining in your eyes. That's the important part. And there must be parking structures and so forth around to meet that goal. And simply stand there and look to the north, although when the aurora is really good, it'll cover the entire sky. And it shows spectacular colors, vivid movement, just a magnificent spectacle, a really good one, really strong one. You can see through light pollution, you can even see through full moonlight, which we do not have tonight. In fact, a really good aurora, and this is not at all uncommon, you probably have an average of 10 of them or so per decade. They tend to cluster around times of high solar activity in East Lansing. You can read a newspaper at night by its light, you know, when you're out in the country. So they're really spectacular things, and the movement is just unbelievable. Well, I want to give you a chance to get out and see that, you know, while there's still something in the night left. So try to cut it back a little bit for that, too. Question way back there. Can they be photographed? A really bright one you could photograph with practically any camera if it can take a time exposure. A real simple box camera where all you can do is press a button and nothing else, the answer would be no. Even the bright ones would be too faint. But if you've got anything above that level, the answer is yes. Fasten it down real hard. If you don't have a tripod, just, you know, lots and lots of rubber bands, fasten it to something heavy. Aim it up in the general direction of north, you know, somewhere up in the sky. Get something pretty in the foreground, some trees or buildings or something to give it a composition. And then just use the fastest film you've got, and if you happen to have some particular film in your camera right now, you know, use that. And try a whole bunch of different exposures. Try 5 seconds, 60 seconds, 5 minutes, you know, a bunch of things like that, and one of them's going to turn out. The picture, your best film is high-speed Ektachrome, and you can have, take it to the camera store, and you can have Kodak develop to a higher than normal speed, that is higher than normal sensitivity to faint light, and that doesn't hurt it very much. You will find that the photograph will not look very much like the way the aurora does to the naked eye. And this, it'll be beautiful, and the shapes will be correct, the colors will be quite different. And the reason for this is that it so happens the way the eye responds to light is not the way the photographic film responds to light. There's a big technical spiel I could go into about if we had all night to do that, but I'm promising to get you out in time to see the thing, so I'm not going to go into that. I want to mention one thing, though, and that is when you see an aurora, very often, many of the phases of it, it changes in their different shapes, and their names are these homogeneous arc, homogeneous glow, drapery aurora, aurora corona, which is most spectacular. That's radiating spikes from a point high up in the sky. And in general, many of these, the drapery and the corona especially, give you aligned appearance, vertical lines of light, and that's fainter in between them. What that is really quite awe-inspiring. The charged particles which cause the aurora are being channeled down to the Earth's magnetic field, and what they're doing is spiraling like this along magnetic field lines. Some of them are more, you know, here's a line that has more of them than one over here just because of irregularities in the distribution of the particles or whatever. We don't know the details of these. But what they are doing is literally drawing for you in the sky the Earth's magnetic field. The same as sprinkling iron filings on a bar magnet to see the lines of force. And this is being done for you in nature, and it seems to me that is that simple fact is a pretty an example of the incredible things that can happen on our planet.
spiraling what causes the shimmering?
The spiraling is not what causes the shimmering. That's way too fast for you to see. When I went like this, that's way too slow. They're going so fast that they can bounce from the north magnetic, from almost the north magnetic pole to almost the south magnetic pole and back again in a time scale of the order of, I don't remember the exact number, something in the order of 10 minutes. And, you know, during that time they do trillions and trillions of spirals. So that's not what we're talking about here at all. Subatomic particles, yeah, protons for the most part. And there are all kinds of details we don't understand about it. For example, is it the particles that are coming directly from the sun that are responsible? It seems not, because it seems though there are not enough of them. When the blob of charged particles, which carry a magnetic field with them since they are electrically charged, hit our magnetic field, they do the same thing to it as happens if you take two bar magnets and try to put their opposite poles together. You can feel them repelling one another, and if you do the bit with the iron filing, you will see the field lines are being distorted. Okay, so here comes this magnetic blob. It comes along, it hits our magnetic field, and goes boing, ours does. And as a result, the subatomic particles, which make up the so-called Van Allen radiation belt above the Earth, and they're not radiation in the sense of light or X-rays or whatever, they're charged particles moving at very high speeds. And we don't know in very much detail where they come from, but somehow they are being fed in from these blobs that hit us from the sun, indirectly, moving around through the back end of the magnetic field, somehow moving down, getting trapped by our magnetic field. Those are held in position above the atmosphere at normal times by our magnetic field. When our magnetic field is distorted that way, they are allowed to be dumped into the upper atmosphere. But that's only part of it. There's much more to it than that. And in fact, we've only just discovered in the last few years that above the place where the aurorae are, an aurora has a height anywhere from 60 miles up to 250 miles or more in some cases. And maybe 10,000 miles above that, you have disturbances in the very, very thin upper atmosphere there. So-called atmosphere that is far thinner than the so-called vacuum in a radio tube, but there is material there. Those disturbances, which are apparently caused by the same groups of particles on the way down that a few minutes or seconds later are going to cause an aurora when they hit the atmosphere further down, produce tremendously intense bursts of radio static with wavelengths of the order of a mile or so, in other words, just below commercial AM. And these make the Earth one of the strongest radio sources we've ever encountered. We didn't even know they existed because these frequencies are bounced by the ionosphere. So here's a radio station, and here you are, and here's the ionosphere. The radio station sends signals up, and they bounce off it like this. These signals are coming from above, and they bounce off the ionosphere in the other direction and go back out again. So we didn't even know they existed, despite their intensity, until we had spacecraft up there. Well, the two Voyager spacecraft, the same ones that we're just talking about, on the way to Jupiter, made the first observation of a particular physical characteristic of those radio signals called circular polarization. And the result is we know now what it is that causes them. It is electrons, not the protons, but electrons. We have some electrons in with the protons, and those electrons are also firing around the magnetic field line, but in the opposite direction because they're oppositely charged. And from the circular polarization, you can tell which direction they're spiraling. And so that's something the Voyagers did that told us something about our own Earth that we didn't know before. We're back.
Can the aurora be artificially
induced? Yes, it's been done. It's been done in a very stupid experiment, in my opinion, because they did it at a time when we still don't know enough, I think, we could do this wisely. And it was done just after the Van Allen belts were discovered. What they did was, this was back when all the space flight was done by the military, and I won't claim the scientists never make mistakes either, but I think our track record is a little better. They put an atomic bomb on a rocket, this was before this was against international treaty, and fired it up above the ionosphere and exploded it at a height of 250 miles. It's called Project Argus. And it created an artificial Van Allen belt and did produce artificial aurorae also. So the answer is yes. The problem is, they were lucky. Nothing happened that was terribly dangerous, except, you remember Telstar, one of the earliest communication satellites? It was destroyed by the which is why you never heard about Telstar again. It was not destroyed in the sense that the atom bomb blast blew it up or anything like that, but the charged particles that were released by the atom bomb blast, the electrons, destroyed the solar cells that were producing its power.
And so the satellite is still up there, will be for several thousand years, but, you know, that killed it because it has no power. But for all anybody knew at the time, that could have, that experiment, Project Argus, could have destroyed the Van Allen radiation belt, and we have no idea what that would do to us down here. We simply do not know. So yeah, the answer is, I can answer that question, I wish that I were able to. Okay, so, that take care of her, Rory? All right, so, yeah. I say, we don't know. We have no idea. We just don't know whether the Van Allen belts are, you know, we understand very little about the interaction of the magnetosphere with the upper atmosphere, and even less about the interaction of the upper atmosphere with the lower atmosphere. Part of the reason for that is, you can study the lower atmosphere because we're in it, you know, and you can send balloons up and aircraft and so forth. You can study the very upper atmosphere by sending a satellite up into it, where it's so thin the satellite can still orbit for a long time. But there's a region in the middle where neither of those methods will work. And we know much less about that region for just that reason. The only thing you can do is send a rocket through it and get a few minutes of data on the way through and then a few minutes more on the way back. So we know very much less about it. Okay, let's take two more Aurora questions, but I did promise you a lecture about black holes. Gentleman in the red shirt back there standing up.
I have a black hole.
You have a black hole question. Well, go ahead. I was hoping not to, but... Yeah, I'm going to talk about that, honest. That was what... I referred to it already. In fact, that was what I meant by M87. Okay? Let's make that... That may have been fact. Okay? And one more question. There was one back there. Yeah. That will be one of the reasons for doing that, sure. The bit there is you send a space shuttle orbiter up and you let down a fishing line maybe 50 miles long and carry instruments at the end of that line. It seems incredible, but it's been shown we can actually do it. So this is one of the many things we're going to do in shuttle here. But if you want information about the space shuttle, then that's a separate lecture. Two more announcements. And those are, very briefly, WKAR is back taping us, and we don't know yet whether it's going to be broadcast. The gentleman is taping it, and they're going to listen to it and decide whether they can broadcast it. And I suspect he's going to find the beginning is awfully chaotic. I hope this can be edited in some way to get the Aurora part out and so forth. But in any case, if you want to find out when it would be broadcast, phone WKAR, talk to Dan Wardlow, who is their producer, and he gave me permission to say in public, yes, he's the one to talk to, so, you know, if he gets a million phone calls, it's his own fault. Finally, we have, and I have no idea when it would be broadcast, probably several months from now at least. Finally, we have a new version, brand new, literally hot off the press this afternoon, of the astronomy schedule of events at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Now, I know many of you took this thing and didn't know what it was, and if you've discovered it's Ann Arbor and you don't want Ann Arbor, I'd really appreciate it if you come up and put it back or simply leave it on one of the chairs by the door and we'll pick it up. You know, there's no point in wasting them. But if you would like a copy either for yourself or for a friend in Ann Arbor or whatever, you know, lots of people from Michigan State do come down to Ann Arbor. It's not all that hard. And in particular, furthermore, we're friendly. You know, we'll welcome you when we get there. Just don't say where you're from, and it's fine. I always enjoy that kind of thing because, you know, I love the U of M and I love Michigan State, and I've given many good lectures at both, and it always amuses me that people worry about football teams when both institutions have so many more important things, you know, both all of which are good. The flip side of the schedule lists a series of events that I do called the Astronomical Film Festival, which in fact has gotten to the point where, yes, there are still films, but it's lots of lectures by me as well. And they will be going on throughout the spring and summer this year for the very first time in history. And I think many of you might be interested in those. some of you, you know, you come here because it was black holes, and all of a sudden you realize that you've got tremendous interest in space and just hadn't realized it and really wish you'd been here for Voyager and so on. Well, you've got another chance to do it in Ann Arbor and a bunch of other things the same way. So, you know, be sure to pick one of these up if you think there's even the same chance that you'll go down there. Now, finally getting to the lecture, black holes. Black holes, as I said, are a theoretical concept. We don't know that they exist. If they exist, the chances are that the most common way that they form anyway is as a certain type of dead star. And so the first thing that I've got to do is tell you what a live star is. And by a live star, I mean one that is still shining, one that is still producing energy. There is no such thing as an infinite energy source. If there were, Einstein's equation, energy equals mass times a certain conversion factor, which happens to be the speed of light squared, but the important thing is energy and mass are the same thing. Something that has more energy than something else weighs more for that reason. A hot iron weighs a tiny bit more than a cold iron. A flashlight battery is fully charged, weighs more than the same battery when it's been exhausted and so forth and so on. What all that means is that if there was such a thing as an infinite energy source, then you would have an infinite amount of mass associated with it, and of course we would be able to measure that. So, you know, the sun and any other star does not have an infinite energy source, and the mere fact that I can see the stars tells me that they must all change and die someday. They must go out someday. Irrespective of anything that I may know about the physical mechanisms that keep them shining, all that kind of thing, the mere fact that they do shine, that they are throwing away energy in the form of light and other electromagnetic radiations into space, means that someday they're going to run out of whatever it is that keeps them going, that keeps them, that allows them to do that. So, stars must die. And so in order to tell you what happens to a star when it dies, I first have to tell you what a star is like when it's alive. Now, as those of you who have been to previous lectures are aware, generally I am much more merciful to you. By this stage, I have long since turned out the lights so that you can look at some pretty slides instead of me. I have some slides about black holes, but I'm going to put them on only at the very end, and so you're going to have to stare at me for most of the lecture, and I apologize, and that's the other reason I'm trying to make it short. I have, however, a very nice little diagram, which it turns out, by sheer accident, fits in very perfectly to this beginning part of the lecture, telling you what a star is. This was prepared by a very bright young lady by the name of Lisa Lutensky, who is the sister of a friend of mine who is in the audience named Mary Jo Lutensky. And Lisa Lutensky is in fourth grade and gave a lecture on astronomy recently to the second grade, which is slave labor kind of... it's a very good idea. It gives them a chance to get in teaching at an early age. And so she wanted to start out with the basics, same as I do, and she prepared an excellent slide, which starts out with the basics. Can I say that? Stars are not pointed. They do not have 5 points or 4 points or any other number of points. You have seen one star close up, and that is our own star, the Sun. That is a very different appearing object from the other stars in the sky, simply because it is so very, very much closer to us. My favorite illustration of that is that if you had a spaceship which could travel at a steady speed, which is ridiculous, they never do, but travel at steady speed and a straight line, which is also ridiculous, at a speed of 1,000,000 miles an hour, which is a lot faster than we've ever actually gone, you could get to the Moon in 15 minutes, you could reach the nearest planet, Venus, in a day, you could reach the farthest planet, Pluto, in 5 months. To get to the nearest star, the Sun, it would take you 4 days. To get to the second nearest star that you see in the night sky, Alpha Centauri, it would take you 3,000 years at the same speed. And that is the nearest other star. And that is, in fact, a typical kind of distance between stars in our part of the universe, at least. And so the next one would be 3,000 years farther, and the one after that would be 3,000 years beyond that, and so on out. And to reach even the average naked eye star, the average star visible without a telescope, which is still unusually close compared to most stars in our galaxy, let alone the rest of the universe, it would take you 1/3,000,000 years at the same speed you could reach the Moon in 15 minutes. So, of course, the Sun is going to appear very differently in the sky than other stars. It's the only star we can study close up. It's the only star that, therefore, we have some idea of what it looks like in detail, whether it has sunspots, solar flares, prominences, that sort of thing. And in many cases, we do not know answers to very simple questions like that about other stars, even though we can tell you, or think we can tell you, things that are very much more complex than that. for example, what will be the central temperature of the star Antares exactly 1.2 billion years from now? Answer zero. We'll blown up by then. That's easy. But, you know, some that aren't quite that trivial we can answer as well, or at least so we think. Well, the sun then is a star. And the shape of a star is the shape of the sun, and as you know from looking at the sun in the sky, that is perfectly round, and there's a very simple reason for that. Its own gravity pulls it into that shape. The gravity is pulling in all directions equally. The sun's gravity is very much stronger than the Earth's. If you could stand at the surface of the sun, if there were a surface, which in fact there isn't, but it looks as though there is when you look at the sun, you'd find the gravity there is 27 times as strong as it is on the Earth, which means that if you weigh 100 pounds on the Earth, at the surface of the sun, you would be well over a ton of hot glowing gas. So the sun has a very strong gravity, and that is pulling in all directions into the center, and simple considerations of geometry, of symmetry, guarantee it's going to be a sphere. All right, so stars are round. Number two, the stars, and this includes the sun, are not made of fire. The sun is not burning, and neither are the other stars. As a matter of fact, they are too hot to burn. If you could start a fire on the sun, it would go out. The reason that the sun is so very bright, and the reason the other stars shine, is not that they're on fire, but simply that they are very, very, very hot, and like anything else that is very, very hot, they glow. It's as simple as that. And so consider what happens if you have a hot plate, an electric hot plate, and you plug it in, you turn it on, the electricity goes through it, and you have a heating element. I'm being careful not to use the word burner, because my whole point is it doesn't literally burn. It shines, it glows, but it doesn't burn, right? Anything that is hot will glow, okay? So the sun is shining because it is hot. What keeps it hot is a separate question. The reason that the element, the heating element shines, is that it is hot. But there's a separate reason that it's hot, and that is the electricity is sent through it. The reason the sun is shining is something called thermonuclear reactions in the deep interior. That is a very interesting story, but also a very long one. It's peripheral to what we're talking about here. So suffice it to say that there is an energy source, and since it can't be infinite, someday the sun's going to run out. In fact, that energy source will keep the sun, has kept the sun going for just short of 5 billion years. It will keep the sun going for another 5 billion years. So the sun is about halfway through a total lifetime of about 10 billion years. Incidentally, one of the many respects in which a star is not like a fire is that as they get older and run out of fuel, they actually use up the remaining fuel faster and faster and therefore become brighter and hotter, just the opposite of what you would intuitively expect as they get old. And so the sun will continue to shine for another 5 billion years, but in about 2 billion years, it will be enough hotter than it is now, the temperatures on the Earth will reach the boiling point of water. So if you want to know when the Earth will become unsuitable for life, it is not when the sun dies. It is only about half that, a little bit less than half that far into the future. By then, you know, I remind you, this is 2 billion years in the future, so I suggest you don't go home and worry about it. People sometimes say, well, do you think we will develop the ability to go to other stars by then? And the answer is, you know, what do you mean we? We are talking about a time into the future that is something like 4 times as long as it has taken for evolution to go all the way from nothing but single-celled animals and plants all the way up to that pinnacle of nature's creation, my own humble self. And there is no reason to assume that nature is, that evolution is so proud of what it has done that it is going to come to a screeching halt just because it produced us, you know. So I would suggest that we leave it to creatures which are presumably as far beyond us as we are beyond Volvox, to worry about what they're going to do when the temperature reaches the boiling point of water. We got our own crises in the next 50 years, let alone the next 2 billion. But that is going to happen. So, Shakespeare has this line about, doubt thou the stars are fire, but never doubt my love. If I were the girl, I'd worry. Okay, how hot is the sun? The coolest part of it is the part that looks like the surface, the so-called surface of the sun. It's all, there is no surface, but it looks like a surface for, again, reasons that are very interesting but too long to go into. That coolest part is just about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that there is no known substance which could remain solid or even liquid, not only at the surface of the sun, but even a million miles away from the surface of the sun if it stayed there very long. That has, so the sun is entirely gaseous. Most of the sun, 99% of its atoms, are hydrogen and helium, and those are substances that are gases even here on the Earth. But there are all the substances in the sun, all the atoms anyway, that make up our minerals and our rocks and our metals and so forth on the Earth. There's iron in the sun, for example. However, it is gaseous. At those temperatures, it could not possibly be anything else. There is gaseous iron in the sun. It's quite easy to show that spectroscopically. So this has two important implications. One is, nobody's ever going to land on a star. In the first place, if it's a star like the sun, as soon as you got within a million miles of it, no matter what your spaceship was made of, you and it would turn into a puff of gas. That is considered counterproductive in the space agency. In the second place, even if you could somehow stand the temperature, there would be nothing to land on. Because if it's that hot that it would turn anything into gas, then no matter what the sun is made of, it itself must be entirely gaseous, simply by virtue of its temperature. In fact, the coolest part is the surface. You don't have to get very far inside before you reach temperatures of several million degrees, and at the center, the temperature is of the order of 20 million degrees, which is hotter than the center of an exploding atomic bomb. And as a matter of fact, an atomic bomb gets its energy by a process somewhat like that. It does keep the sun hot, keeps it shining. Actually, a hydrogen bomb is a better analogy, and I'm sorry to say that people got the idea for how to build hydrogen bombs from theoretical astrophysical studies that date back to the 1930s of how the sun shines. Never underestimate theoretical astrophysics. And the gravity in Jupiter, which is strong, not as strong as the sun, but still very strong, compresses it, and indeed, Jupiter, too, is made mostly of hydrogen and helium, but there you find that most of the interior, you've got gaseous layer, and then most of the interior is, in fact, liquid. In the case of the sun, though, when you go through the calculations, you find that at every level, the temperature goes up enough faster than the pressure that you do not have a solid or a liquid at any point, even the central core. In fact, it's a rather thin gas most of the way through. At the surface, the gas pressure, the so-called surface is actually a layer a few hundred miles deep called the photosphere, and of course a few hundred miles is negligible compared to the size of the sun, and so it looks like a perfectly nice sharp edge when you look at it from the Earth. But that the pressure there varies from about 100, the atmospheric pressure in this room at the top, to still only about a tenth the atmospheric pressure in this room at the bottom. You have to go almost halfway from the surface to the center before you reach even the atmospheric pressure in this room. Then, so the sun is not only made of gas, it's made of rather thinly distributed gas. And then the pressure does mount up rather rapidly. 4/10 of the way in, you hit atmospheric pressure. A little bit below that, you hit the density of, say, water. A little bit below that, the density of rock. A little bit below that, the density of iron, density of platinum. And by the time you hit the center of the sun, you are dealing with things that are 300 times as heavy as an equal volume of water. In other words, 300 grams per cubic centimeter, and that is of the order of 10 times as dense as the densest substances that we know, such as platinum and osmium and iridium and those things. But it is still a gas because at that point the temperature has reached 20 million degrees, and that is definitely sufficient to keep it gaseous. However, I think you begin to see that your ordinary intuition about how materials behave based on substances at Earth's sources of pressures and temperatures are not always going to serve you very well when you're talking about the inside of the sun. You have a substance here which is very different from anything that you've ever dealt with at the Earth. It is 20 times as dense as an equal amount of platinum, and yet it is absolutely gaseous. In fact, it actually is closer to being a mathematical gas, what is called an ideal gas, and their equations, the oversimplified equations again, which are nice in cases where the errors are small enough that you can use them. The equation called the ideal gas law, which is very simple. You actually come up with less error if you use the ideal gas law for the center of the sun than if you do for the air in this room. Closer to being an ideal gas.
Is that what it's called, a plasma?
It is definitely what it's called, a plasma. A plasma is a gas which is... So, in fact, a lot of physicists will argue it's not a gas at all, so it's so different from a gas, it's more different from a gas than a liquid is, and so it's a fourth state of matter. I'm just lumping them all together and calling them gases. A plasma is a gas which consists of atoms that have been torn apart, okay? You have been told at some point in your life that all matter in the universe is made of atoms. That is sheer Earth chauvinism. It so happens that we live in a location where much of the matter does indeed consist of complete atoms, but virtually the entire universe, almost half of which is matter inside stars, and almost all of the rest of which is matter between stars, which is a plasma for a different reason. It's cold there, but it gets turned into a plasma for a different reason. Consists of fragments of atoms. nuclei, sometimes with electrons going around them, sometimes not at all, and then bare naked electrons floating around elsewhere and not joining onto the nuclei. In the case of the sun, because the temperature is so violent, high temperature in a gas simply means the atoms are moving around at very, very high speed. The atoms in this room, you know, a gas consists of atoms that are moving around at different velocities. It is not just a pile of atoms that are sitting there in a puddle not moving. That's a liquid or a solid, but particularly that's a solid. The gas in this room consists mostly of nitrogen and oxygen molecules, and they're moving at an average speed of about 1,000 miles per hour. They are bombarding your skin constantly and every other surface in this room and bouncing off it at that kind of speed. Now, if those were rifle bullets traveling at that speed, of course they'd kill you, but they're not. They're only tiny little molecules, and so they don't penetrate and you don't feel pain, but what you do feel is you have nerves in every square millimeter of your skin that are set up to respond to this constant bombardment and report to your brain sensations which your brain interprets as it's hot or it's cold. Okay? Make the temperature in the room hotter, make the temperature very, very much hotter, and you'll find the atoms are going very, very much faster. And so in the center of the sun, the atoms are going so fast, they collide with one another so violently, in fact, not just the center, but all through the sun, except for the very, very outermost layer, even then it happens to some extent, the collisions are so violent of the atoms with each other that they knock electrons off one another. Now, in the case of a hydrogen atom, this particularly matters, because a hydrogen atom consists of only one proton as its nucleus with a single electron revolving around it, all right? The diameter of the atom is the diameter of the orbit of that electron, and that is just about 1/250 millionth of an inch, which is a unit that is referred to as an angstrom after a turn-of-the-century Swedish physicist. Okay, so if you knock off that electron, if you knock off one electron from any other atom, what you've got is an atom that's slightly smaller. But if you knock off an electron from a hydrogen atom, all you have left is the proton. The proton is about 10,000 times smaller in diameter than is the orbit of that electron. In other words, the nucleus is about 10,000 times smaller than the atom. If you had a scale model of an atom, and it was the size of a football stadium, and you put it down the football stadium, the nucleus would be about the size of a garden tee in the middle of the 50-yard line there. Another analogy is the nucleus is to the atom as a bunch of grapes is to the state of Texas. So that means that all of a sudden, since the volume of something goes as a cube of its diameter, if you ionize the atom, you have made it 1/1,000,000,000,000 as big as it was before. Which means that since all the matter in the center of the sun is ionized, and most of it's hydrogen, the matter in the center of the sun consists of particles which are separated from one another compared to their own diameters by distances enormously greater than the particles that make up the air in this room compared to their own diameters. Okay? So the distances in inches or in angstroms or however you want to measure it is very much tinier, but the particles themselves are so much smaller. And that's why I said that the center of the sun is closer to being an ideal gas, which, see, the mathematical equations assume the particles are separated by huge distances compared to their own diameters, so they don't interact with one another except at the actual moment of collision, all right? Because the forces between them are too tiny at those big distances. That's why it's closer to being an ideal gas. If some of you are wondering if I'm simply going off on an enormous tangent here, I'm not. I'm delighted to answer questions, and so happens that these questions are leading me right into what I was going to say anyway. So all of this is part of the lecture, and don't worry about it, and please do ask any questions at any point as you go along. No. Theoretical calculations. The question is, how do we know how long the sun's going to live? It's all from what we know about the laws of physics, how thermonuclear reactions operate, the ideal gas law, and that sort of thing. So this, too, is theory. Not nearly as purely theoretical as black holes, however, because after all, we can observe stars shining. We know stars exist, and we can check the predictions of our theories indirectly. We can't say, okay, we think this star is going to last 10 billion years, let's wait and see, you know, and this one has, but we can make other types of observations. For example, there should be a certain relationship between how heavy a star is and how luminous it is. Well, it does exist, and it exists just the way theory says it should. So this particular theory is pretty good. Somebody's going to bring up the solar neutrino experiment at this point. I'm going to say, I'm sorry, that's a separate lecture. We have our problems still in explaining what we observe.
Well, I was just going to ask, is what
elements you're expounding now pre or post neutrino?
What I'm expounding now is post-is pre-neutrino because nobody knows what to do about this solar neutrino experiment. They're just hanging fire and hoping it'll go away.
You were describing the plasma, and I was curious, are there any
strategies
that are similar to liquid helium
case plasma? Do plasmas have problems anything like liquid helium? Not the weird ones. I mean, you know, obviously some, but just the fact they flow and that sort of thing. No, if you want a plasma, there are plenty of them in this room, inside this fluorescent light tube. That's a plasma. Bunch of electrons supplied by Detroit Edison or Consumer Power or wherever you get them from here, zipping through a gas, a very rarefied mercury vapor atom. And that's a plasma. How do you determine the temperature of the sun? Bunch of ways you can do that, one of which is how would you determine the temperature of a heating element, roughly anyway? Answer, look at its color. If it's red hot, it's cooler than if it's orange. So a red-hot star, a red star, is one of the very few things in stellar astrophysics that are really simple. A star is the color it is because of how hot it is, okay? A red star like Antares, whose name means an ancient Greek rival of Mars because people were forever thinking it was a red planet Mars, and people make the same mistake now in audience question series and planetaria, you know, so you can, that's a nice way to lead into what the name of the star is. Red star like Antares is the coolest kind of star. It's cooler than the sun. A little bit hotter is a star like Arcturus, which, or Aldebaran, which is orange. A little bit hotter still is a yellow star like Capella, or like the sun. Capella is yellow, very easy way to remember that one. A little bit hotter than the sun is a white star, such as Procyon, or Spica. And the very hottest stars, these are now two, three, even sometimes more hot than the sun, are the blue-white stars, such as Sirius, Vega, Deneb. Those can be seen over tremendous distances. They're quite rare, but many of the naked eye stars are those because they're visible over enormously greater distances than your dim red thing, unless the red ones are very, very large, which sometimes happens. Then even though each square meter is relatively faint, there are so many square meters that, you know, the star, well, Antares is a good example. There's one thing in common with Mars. If you could wave a magic wand and make the center of Antares appear where the center of the sun is, 93 million miles from the Earth, the Earth would be buried deep inside the sun, the star. And so, in fact, with Mars. That star is bigger than the entire orbit of Mars. So, you know, that's called a red supergiant, and that's an example of what happens to a star toward the end of its life. The sun will do that just before it dies 5 billion years from now, not as extremely. It'll become just a red giant, not a red supergiant. And what will happen then is it will get bigger and bigger, swallow Mercury, the nearest planet to it, and then swallow Venus, which is number 2. And because Earth is number 3. Probably, the sun will not get big enough to swallow the Earth. But it will occupy a very large part of the sky, and the temperature here will be far above the boiling point of water, but of course it will have reached that even back when the 2 billion years from now, well before the sun did such a thing. So that's what a star does at the end of its life. And we'll come back to that, too, because remember, we're talking about dying stars in order to lead up to black holes, and so all this is relevant as well. Okay, so, how hot is the sun? Well, 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Stars put out enormous amounts of radiation. I don't know if you have any conception of how bright the sun is, because we are, after all, 93 million miles away from the thing, and so the entire Earth intercepts only a half of 1 billionth of the total radiation the sun puts out. If you could take all of the radiation of this average star, focus it into a single beam and send it in the direction of the Earth, it could boil every drop of the 1.5 million billion tons of water in our oceans in 8 seconds. And in doing that calculation, I included the amount of heat necessary to raise the water up to boiling temperature, as well as the amount necessary to actually boil. Or put another way, if you made a column of ice, 1 mile in diameter, and stretching 93 million miles from the sun to the Earth, and then turn that beam of the total output of just an average star on that column, it would melt the entire thing in 1.5 seconds. I can show you a star tonight that is 60,000 times as bright as the sun, Deneb. So you see some of the things that we deal with in stellar astrophysics. Just normal astrophysics, just ordinary things like stars. I haven't even gotten into some of the more exotic things. Really tremendous amounts of energy. That's the other reason the sun is not made of fire. It couldn't possibly. You couldn't conceivably get that much amount of energy out of fire for any reasonable length of time. If the entire sun were made of coal, very best grade Pennsylvania anthracite. And honeycombs with, I come from Pennsylvania, so, honeycombs with tubes, you know, and ventilation fans and so forth to blow oxygen to it to burn the coal at peak efficiency. To produce that amount of energy, the sun would burn itself completely out to a cinder in something of the order of 10,000 years. Well, if they didn't go on strike, that's true. The sun has been shining at more or less a steady rate, because we know from geologic evidence that there's been liquid water on the Earth, so the temperature is between the freezing point and the boiling point of water on the Earth, for at least the past 3.8 billion years. Billion, see. So clearly it's something that is very, very much more efficient as an energy source than simple combustion.
You would say, what would you say in a one-simple statement, a black hole is?
Well, I haven't gotten to that yet, but we're leading up to it. She wants a simple statement of what a black hole is. A black hole is the region surrounding a Schwarzschild singularity. Okay? We'll get to that. Make that a singularity period, not necessarily Schwarzschild. Could be Kerr, could be some other kind. There is no simple explanation, and that is why if you read newspaper writers insist on doing everything in one paragraph no matter whether it can be done or not. That's why you've never been able to understand newspaper explanations about a black hole. It's not that the reporter necessarily doesn't know. It's that there are certain things that just can't be explained in one sentence, not because they're hard to understand, but just because you've got to give all this background first. See? So, first we go through a fun lecture on what a star is, and eventually we get to black hole. Okay, so, I think we've said enough about what a star is. Let's summarize it. There are five ingredients to the description of a star. I think I tell you five. I knew I was leaving something out. They're very large compared to planets. You know what a planet is, so let's start off with that. The sun is an average-sized star. If the sun were hollow, you could drop in just over 1 million Earths into the space inside. Jupiter is the biggest planet of all. If it were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Earths, and so if the sun were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Jupiters. And of course, Antares is much, much bigger, much, much far bigger than the sun, and the sun is bigger than the Earth. It is much more than a million times bigger than the sun. There are also stars that are a good deal smaller than the sun. The sun is just about in the middle, a little bit above the average, but not very much. So, stars are enormously big. Now, what a star is then is a very large, very hot ball of glowing gas. Five elements. Now, the interesting thing about the size of a star is not so much how enormous that size is per se, as the fact that the star has got to be that particular size and no other. The law of the physics requires, and here's why. What I'm doing now is introducing, having told you what a star is, I'm now getting to part two, which is introducing a concept called hydrostatic equilibrium, which is what determines what the size of a star is. The sun is made of gas. Gas has no strength. The gravity there, as I told you, is very strong. So you might ask yourself, if that gravity is so strong, why doesn't it simply suck all the matter into the center until the sun is the size of a ping pong ball? The answer is that if you take a gas and you make it occupy a smaller volume, which is to say you compress it, you heat it up, right? Everybody knows that. Who has ever pumped air into a bicycle tire, you keep compressing the gas in the column of air in that bicycle pump, and as you do so, you are constantly heating it up, and therefore, the increased heat gives you increased pressure gives you increased heat, and that hot gas heats up the wall of the tube, and you touch the tube, and you're like, you're going to actually hurt yourself. And that's just from a simple little bicycle pump. The reason for this is very simple. If you remember what temperature in a gas is, that is to say, a measure of the average speed of the atoms or molecules or whatever it is that it's made of. Suppose we take the gas in the air in this room, and suppose the room were airtight, and we move the walls in until the room was only half its volume. As we move them in, molecules would come and they'd every once in a while a molecule would hit one of the walls and bounce off, and since the wall is moving, the molecule would bounce off with more speed than it had when it came in. Alright? Just because the wall is moving. And you don't have to have a wall if you're doing the compression by some other force, for example, gravity. Somehow you turn on gravity and make it stronger than it was before. Don't ask me how you do that. Again, you're making the molecule has moved systematically, and therefore you're giving them a higher speed than they had before. And although that is a systematic speed, that is a speed only in one direction, as soon as that molecule that you have just given the extra speed to by the moving wall or by the gravity or whatever bounces off a few other molecules, it shares its extra speed, its extra energy of motion with the other molecules in the gas. They're constantly moving around, banging into one another, interchanging speed, one slows up, one speeds up, one slows down. There's a well-defined average in a given moment, and if you inject some extra speed into the gas, then very quickly that is randomized by all the collisions within the molecules of the gas, and what's happening is you heat up the gas, right? Likewise, if you make the gas expand, if you pull it apart, then you are pulling some molecules out from the inside and thereby making them slow down. And so when you expand the gas, it cools down. All right? The more temperature a gas has, the hotter the pressure. The higher the pressure. Because what is the pressure exerted by a gas? Well, it's simply the net effect of all those collisions, right? And the higher the speed of the collisions, the higher the pressure. Okay, and that's why if you heat up a gas, the pressure of that gas increases. Well, put all this together now. Suppose, here's the sun sitting there. Any given atom within the sun has on it forces which are trying to pull it inward, and those are gravity, and we're trying to understand why that doesn't, in fact, manage to pull it inward, because there are other forces which are trying to push it out. One of those is the pressure of the gas itself. In the sun, that's the most important. In bigger and hotter and brighter stars, there is actually another force, which is the pressure of the light itself, the storm of radiation coming out from the inside of the star. In the case of the sun, that's only about one-tenth as important as the gas pressure. You get up to bigger stars, which are brighter stars, and very quickly, in fact, you can understand why bigger stars are brighter stars, okay? Bigger star, more matter, means more gravity pushing into the center, which means that it has to heat itself up to a higher temperature, so it has a higher gas pressure to overcome that gravity and push it apart, right? So the heavier the star, the brighter it's going to be, okay? And the radiation pressure goes up very rapidly as you increase the temperature of the star, to the point where if a star becomes about 60 times as heavy as the sun, radiation pressure would actually blow it apart. Therefore, you cannot have a star that is more than 60 times as heavy as the sun. And that was figured out back in the 1930s by Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, one of the earliest of the stellar astrophysicists, when all this that I'm telling you now was just being painfully worked out. And one of the big triumphs of early theoretical astrophysics, the sort of thing that answers the question you asked about how we know these things, was that that is, in fact, the observed upper limit of how heavy stars are. I don't know how heavy stars are by measuring the strength of their gravitational field on other stars that may be revolving around them. More than half the stars in the universe are double stars, in case where one star is revolving around the other, the way the moon revolves around the Earth. Got a question way in the back here. A galaxy is not a single star, however. I'm sorry? There is such a thing as a double galaxy, one revolving around another. In fact, we live in a triple galaxy. Our galaxy has two satellite galaxies, which are called the Magellanic Clouds. You can't see them from here, they're only visible in the southern hemisphere.
Well, what does that
mean, expansion? They're not expanding. Expansion occurs only at a higher scale than that, expansion of the universe as a whole. I don't understand what you're getting at. So what happened then, as a matter of fact, is they turn into a black hole. If the radiation pressure didn't blow them apart first. It would be a nice... It depends on how heavy it is. If the thing was a little bit heavier than 60 times as heavy as the sun, what he's asking is, what would happen if you could artificially take two stars, each say 50 times as heavy as the sun, which is okay, and put them together? You know, what would you get? Well, in that case, what you get, if you put them together gently enough that, you know, they didn't simply splash, in which case what you have is an expanding cloud of gas, what you would have would be a single star which would immediately blow itself apart by radiation pressure, and so you would indeed have an expanding cloud of gas. If it were much heavier than that, thousands of times heavier than the sun, then, in fact, the whole thing would turn into a black hole. But to explain that, I still haven't told you what a black hole is, so that would have to require me to jump ahead a bit. We'll come to that. Okay, then what is... I just don't understand what you...
I said you have an evolution.
I don't think you can argue that stars. I don't think you can argue that stars form themselves together in collections called galaxies because they somehow knew there was an upper limit on their size. For one thing, we believe the galaxies came first and star formation occurred only after the matter of the universe had separated into large galaxy-sized blobs. But I don't think stars were that smart, you know. What was I telling you about? Okay, I was telling you about what would happen if... Okay, hydrostatic equilibrium is the idea that all of the forces on any given atom inside a star are exactly in balance. Everything pulling it down, there's only one such force, that's gravity, is counterbalanced by all the things that are pushing it out, and there are two such forces, those are gas pressure and radiation pressure. Okay? So that's called hydrostatic equilibrium. Now, suppose you try to disrupt it. This will show you why it works in the first place. Suppose a giant could come along and squeeze the sun in his hands until it's half its present size. Well, then what would happen would be the gravity would remain the same. Gravity is determined only by the amount of matter that the star has. But the gas pressure would tremendously increase because the compression of the matter has raised the temperature of the gas. Okay? And so when the giant let go, the sun would not be in hydrostatic equilibrium. And so the gas pressure would be greater than the gravity, which means that all the matter would begin moving outwards. But as it moved outwards, that constitutes an expansion of the gas, right? Therefore, a cooling of the gas. And what's going to happen is it's going to expand until just the point where the temperature is such that the gas pressure is like what it is now, which is to say the point where the gas pressure equals gravity. And that will stop. So you see, the sun must be the size that it is now, and no other. Actually, I'm oversimplifying a little. In fact, what would happen is that when the gas reached that equilibrium size, it would still be moving, see? And so it would overshoot. It would get a little bit too big. And then it would discover, gravity is still pulling it back, finally the gravity would pull it to a stop, and then it would discover that it was in a circumstance in which it's now so big that gravity is stronger than the gas pressure at this new, larger size and therefore lower temperature, and so it would start falling inward again. Again, it would reach the equilibrium size, still moving, and overshoot. And so what would happen would be that it would reach a certain maximum compression, and then it would be too hot again, start expanding again, and so forth. What would happen would be the sun would oscillate back and forth, beating like a giant heart. And to give you some idea of how much we know about stellar astrophysics, the length of time it would take for one complete oscillation, smallest to biggest to smallest again, would be 6.3 days. Try it and see. We wonder how that quasar is too. Nobody knows what a quasar is. That's the short answer. They may or may not be related to the black hole phenomenon, which, believe it or not, I'm about to get to. We don't know how big a quasar is, but the remarkable thing about them is not how big they are, but how small they are. They are, if you can believe their distances, which is a matter of controversy and is also a separate lecture, then they are brighter than entire galaxies of several hundred billion stars added together, and yet they are no bigger than our own solar system or a few times the size of our own solar system, and they may be smaller than that. We don't know their size, we've only got an upper limit on their size. And what could possibly produce that much energy from that little volume is one of the major unsolved problems in astrophysics today. And quasars were discovered 10 years ago, and practically everything that we know about them was found out in the first year or two, and since then it's been almost completely static subject, just because nobody's been able to make any headway. For the first time since, well, for the first time since we realized what those little fuzzy spots of light in the night sky were, they were galaxies as opposed to something else, back in the 1930s. Early 30s, late 20s even, depending on how certain you were at the time, we are faced with the existence of a complete class of physical phenomena, of astronomical objects, of whose physical nature we do not have any knowledge. You know, you ask me what a star is, I can tell you. Ask me what a planet is, what a comet is, what a nebula is, what a galaxy is, all those things I can tell you. Maybe I can't tell you in as much detail as we'd like, but at least I can give you a rough idea. Ask me what a quasar is,
and we have the foggy image. Do I see a hand over here somewhere? Sorry, Dave. Yeah.
This oscillation will vary as the sun gets
older. Yeah, what happens is the oscillation goes on for about 300 years with each one just a tiny bit smaller than the last one because you're losing energy by friction, and finally comes to rest at the equilibrium side. Now, of course, all that is very irrelevant to reality since there are no giants to come along and do this, but there is a whole class of stars called pulsating variable stars which do exactly this thing. That is, they pulsate, they oscillate like giant hearts. And depending, it turns out that it's the average density of the star that determines how long one pulsation takes. Nothing else. It's the average density. And that varies a lot from one kind of star to another. So you get pulsating variables that do it in time periods of the order of a few tens of minutes, all the way up to ones that do it in the order of many years. In fact, entirely possible that one's longer than that. If it varies over a long enough time scale, you don't realize it's varying. So we probably have an observational bias against the real long period ones. What's keeping those going is that there is an instability within them that keeps putting the energy back in that is lost by the friction on each oscillation. What got them oscillating in the first place is another more interesting question, which we don't know as much about. I can't get into a lecture about pulsating variables either. Wait a minute.
What name do you say pulsating variables?
Pulsating variables occur at various stages of various kinds of stars' lives, that is, various masses of stars. Most of them are post main sequence and even post red giant or red supergiant stages. Main sequence means a normal kind of star that's shining the same way the sun is, and a typical star spends the majority of its life in the main sequence portion of its life, and that's why it's called main sequence to begin with. There are some cases, however, where there are pulsating variables which are happening apparently in stars that are still in the process of formation. I'm thinking of T. Tauri stars especially, which are stars that apparently are in the process of just being born. And of course, that's a very exciting thing, too, to have made that discovery. We've got several hundred of them. The upper limit of mass of star, actually, of how heavy the star is. No, see, size is not necessarily correlated with mass. It is if the star is shining by the same if the two stars are shining by the same mechanism. But our sun is shining by a thermonuclear process which involves converting hydrogen to helium. There are other stars which are shining because they're converting, say, carbon to oxygen. That's going to give you a different relation between size and mass. If you don't know what the word mass means, assume that it means weight. There is a difference, but if you don't know the word, then you don't know enough physics to be bothered by the difference. The biggest single thing that we know of, that depends on your definition of what you mean by single thing. You know, we went through this a few minutes ago, that is a galaxy, a single object. I think the standard answer to that is a so-called radio galaxy, which isn't a galaxy, it's a huge cloud of gas, which is called 3C123 and is about 20 million light years across, if I remember the number correctly. Do you remember? There are several of these supergiant radio blobs, whatever they are. We have no idea what their origin is, you know, why they're there. It's only been discovered in the last few years. But you see, that's an object that is very different in nature from a star, where you have a single relatively compact body that is quite hot, and where you have this nice simple balance of forces that I was talking about. Okay, yeah. Pulsating variables change brightness mainly, and then if you observe them spectroscopically, you will find that you can actually observe the different motions of them moving in and out. The color changes are relatively minor because the size changes aren't all that big. There is a slight color change, but it's nothing you'd notice with the casual eye. If you would like to see a pulsating variable, however, there's at least one that is easy to follow the variations of with the naked eye in the night sky. Well, there's several. There's a long period one called Myra, and then there is a much shorter period one, about a week or so, called Delta Cepheid. What year the variable starts? So what's the period Delta Cepheid? It's about 6 days, isn't it? Something like that. And you're out of the Cepheid, okay. Specialization. So an amateur astronomer, he specializes not only in variable stars, but in about 50 kinds of variable stars. I suppose that theoretical models exist, but you know, it's going to blow up, and so you're never going to observe one.
Yeah, I never heard of anybody suggesting you could get a black hole by the ultimate contraction of a pulsating variable. That would be, it would take some awful special circumstances. They don't pulsate that much. You know, plus and minus 10% diameter is pretty good, and a lot of them are smaller than that. And yeah, I think there are better ways to generate black holes. So let's continue on with the standard way of generating black hole, which is the death of a normal star. Yeah, I'm getting to it, honest. Listen though, all of this, you know, it may not have been Elvin, it may not have been obvious. This has been a sort of loose format lecture, and that's fine, I kind of enjoy it. But it may not have been obvious how many of the things that I've said I would have said anyway if, you know, I were sitting there, if I were giving the whole lecture and you just all sitting there, your hands folded in your lap. But I much prefer it this way. All of this will come together, believe me. A lot more of it will be relevant when we get to black holes in the probably time. For example, a bit about red giants and red supergiants we're going to have to talk about. Okay, someday a star has got to die, which is to say it has got to run out of the energy source which keeps it hot, which is to say it has got to cool off and stop shining. So what happens to a star that has cooled off, lost its energy source, in terms of hydrostatic equilibrium? Well, what are the forces involved in hydrostatic equilibrium? Gravity depends only on how heavy the star is. So that is not going to be affected by the temperature of the star. Actually, stars lose somewhat of their mass as they grow older, but to a very crude first approximation, the star is as heavy now as it was then, and so the gravity is going to be as strong as it was then. Gravity, in other words, is going to be there the same as before. But gas pressure and radiation pressure, the two forces that are trying to push the star apart, go away when it runs out of its fuel, when it runs out of its energy source. And so, if gravity is still pulling it in and nothing is counteracting that gravity to push it out, I think it's pretty obvious what is going to happen to the star. It is going to collapse and become very much smaller. In fact, that collapse itself, since it constitutes a contraction, will generate a great deal of heat. And the star can continue shining as a result of its very, very, very slow gravitational contraction for as much as 30 billion years. There are many stars known that are doing this. In fact, the second commonest kind of star in our part of the galaxy, and that may very well be true for much of the rest of the universe as well, is stars that are exactly doing that. They are stars that are dead, but they won't admit it yet. And they are very feebly shining by their slow gravitational contraction. They are a class of stars called white dwarfs. I cannot refer you to a single naked eye white dwarf, even though they're so common, because they're so faint. When the sun becomes a white dwarf, it will be about as bright in our Earth sky as the full moon is. So they are so faint that there's not a one visible to the unaided eye, but there is one revolving around the bright star Sirius, and there is one revolving around Procyon, and there are many, many, many others, including some that are quite nearby. In fact, they have to be nearby or we can't find them. But a white dwarf is not simply a blob of matter that is the way the star was, only now it's gotten cold. It is in yet another state of matter. You're going to call a plasma a separate state of matter. You're going to have to call the stuff that it's made of a separate state of matter as well, because it's at least as different from the others that I've mentioned as they are from each other. It is a state of matter that is referred to as degenerate matter. Degenerate is a mathematical technical term. It does not constitute a moral judgment upon the star. To explain degenerate matter to you, I have to explain that Jupiter is the biggest planet that we will ever find. No matter where we go, no matter what weird planets may be revolving around other stars in our galaxy or anywhere else, we may find some that are heavier than Jupiter, but we will never find any that are bigger. And the reason for that is that ordinarily, you think of an object made of, say, ordinary solid matter. Solid matter differs from gaseous matter in that the atoms are touching, all right? So they can't get any closer than they are. And if you have two pieces of solid matter, one of which is twice as heavy as the other, i.e. has twice as many atoms as the other, say two rocks, same kind of rock, you expect the bigger one to be twice as big as the smaller one, right? You expect that an object is bigger as it gets heavier. And the reason is that if it is heavier, it has more atoms, and those atoms are going to take up more space. That is true only until you get to the point where the atoms are capable of maintaining their own, are, as long as you are within the point where they're capable of maintaining their own identity and being next to one another and not touching one another. What keeps them from interpenetrating? After almost all of an atom is empty space. The space is between the electrons and between the nuclei. And so why is it that I can't put my hand through this seemingly very solid stage when I know that in fact both my hand and the stage are virtually entirely empty space? The answer is that the outermost electrons in all the atoms of my hand are electrically charged, negatively charged. The outermost electrons in all of the atoms on the stage are negatively charged also, and negative charges repel one another. So what happens is, at a great distance, it doesn't matter that there are all those negative charges there, because there are also positive charges in the nuclei, and for every electron there is a proton in the nucleus with the opposite charge, and so for every repulsive force there is an attractive force, as long as the two bodies of matter are far enough apart that you can assume that the atoms are points, that their sizes do not matter. But when you get them really close to one another, you have to take into account the fact that these electrons which are repelling one another are closer together than the protons in the corresponding atoms nuclei, which are attracting those same electrons. So you move the atoms in, and until they're very close together, there's neither a net attraction nor a repulsion, and then all of a sudden, wham, there becomes a very, very strong repulsion. If I try to put my hand through the stage, what happens is it floats down until the distance apart of the electrons, the outermost electrons in my hand and the outermost electrons in the matter of the stage, becomes just enough that the amount of the repulsion overcomes the weight of my hand, which is what's pulling it down, trying to pull it down through the stage. If I now press as hard as I can, then what happens is there is now an additional downward force trying to push my hand through the stage, and so it drifts a tiny, tiny bit closer, and then at that distance, the new force of repulsion is just that much greater, and so again it comes to a stop, to an equilibrium. And that is why you cannot put your hand through the stage, because there is no way that you can generate enough force to overcome the tremendous repulsion that you get as the electrons become really, really close together. In a sense, you cannot touch anything. However, as the old joke goes, you can come close enough for all practical purposes. Okay. Although those forces are very strong, those electrostatic forces, which are what prevent you from, for example, squeezing a rock in your bare hands until it becomes that much size, they are not infinite. There is no such thing as an infinite force. There could not be, or you could harness it to get an infinite energy source. All right? What that means is that if I could exert a strong enough pressure on the stage here, I could, in fact, push my hand through it. Of course, in fact, what would happen is the matter would fail along some line of weakness and would simply break. But, you know, I'm talking about an ideal situation where all of the bonds between the atoms are equally strong. The atoms themselves in solid matter are held apart, are not allowed to come any closer than just touching, by these same repulsive forces of their outermost electrons on one another. And so if I take a rock and I try to squeeze it to make it have its present size, in fact what happens is very, very much before I get it to have its present size, I have squeezed the atoms together just a microscopic fraction enough that the new force of repulsion becomes equal to the force that I'm putting on it, and again we have equilibrium and I can't go any further. But if I could generate enough pressure, I could actually force the atoms into one another. I could force them to interpenetrate. How much pressure does that take? Well, the matter at the center of the Earth is under tremendous pressure because the weight of the entire Earth is squashing down on it from all sides. And yet not even there is the pressure anything like big enough. But the matter at the center of Jupiter is just about at the borderline. If the pressure were only a little bit greater at the center of Jupiter, the atoms would in fact begin to interpenetrate. When the atoms interpenetrate, what happens is the outermost electrons are squeezed off all the atoms. So this is yet another way of removing electrons from an atom. We've already talked about one, that is collision. Removing electrons from an atom is called ionization, and this particular version is collisional ionization. Well, now I'm telling you about another one called pressure ionization. What you have, as soon as you pressure ionize matter, is matter which is denser than the same stuff would have been before you applied all that pressure, right? Because you're squeezing the atoms into a smaller space, making them get closer together. You have fragments of atoms arranged very regularly, very geometrically, since the pressures are so high, symmetry is going to force them into a geometrical arrangement like the trees in an orchard, only in three dimensions. And swimming in among this lattice of fragments of atoms is a sea of individual electrons, which no longer can be said to belong to all of them, to any single atom. It belongs to the entire piece of matter as a whole. Those electrons are very much easier to move from one place to another than they would be if you had to tear them off one atom and then as soon as they got to another atom, tear them off that and so forth. So the degenerate matter is extremely good at conducting electricity, which is nothing but a movement of electrons. It's much easier to get the electrons to move in degenerate matter. And of course, the most spectacular thing about degenerate matter is that it is very much denser than ordinary matter. In a typical white dwarf, which is made almost entirely of degenerate matter, because it is so much bigger than Jupiter that the pressure is so much greater that it is, except for the outside where the pressure is the least, the whole star is degenerate. A typical kind of density that you get is such that every cubic centimeter, which is just about the amount of matter that would fill a pinball, weighs several tons. So if you had a sample of this stuff, and if I could hold it up and show it to you, well, there is nothing whatever made of ordinary matter that could hold it, including my hand. It would simply, assuming that somehow you could maintain the pressure, of course, in fact, you could not, and so it would explode in a way that would make an atom bomb look like a wet firecracker. But ignoring that minor difficulty of performing the demonstration, it would simply sink through the floor and through the entire body of the Earth until it came to rest in the center of the Earth. Degenerate matter is known to exist. White dwarfs are made of it. As a matter of fact, for reasons that I can't go into, even under ordinary pressures, it turns out that the arrangement of the forces that hold atoms together, the chemistry involved, physical chemistry involved, is such that in one class of elements, which are called metals, you know, ordinary, the way you ordinarily use the word, in that class, under ordinary pressures, the atoms take up an arrangement such that they are degenerate. And so you have seen samples of degenerate matter.